Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zaret, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Ascot. Now, this episode's all about the booming gut health market. Is the industry missing the opportunity? Despite decades of research, billions spent on ingredients, and a consumer base that's genuinely hungry for gut health solutions, our panel suggests the industry faces a fundamental tension. The science is outpacing what regulators will allow on pack.
So if you can tell us who you are, who do you work for, and also answer the question, where do you see the greatest opportunities for NPD in the gut health market? Just what's your personal perspective on this? So shall we start with you?
Sure. Hi there. My name's Amy. I am the co-founder of Naked Biotics, along with my other co-founder, Leanne, over there. We own a liquid probiotic brand. It's available on the market, in the retail shops at the moment. And I would say that for us, the focus, at the moment we're kind of focused on adult health, but for our NPD, it's really about kids and, you know, the microbiome and really studying that and learning about kids' microbiome and therefore bringing a probiotic for kids into the market. Because what we're learning about gut health is it's much about preventative health as well as fixing problems that are existing in consumers today. So we really want to start that journey from kids being so young and having a healthy microbiome growing up so that you can prevent future issues with the gut health.
Hi everyone, I am Swami and I am the head of product development and innovation at Naturia, which is a home of superfoods in the UK. And what I foresee to be the most successful gut health product would be a combination of pre, post, and probiotics. As she was rightly explaining, you need to have prebiotics, you also need to have probiotics to be able to use the prebiotics. And again, postbiotics seems to have more stable and more benefits. So a true combination in a food that is compatible, which people perceive it to be, you know, good for your digestion, would be a successful one.
Hi, I'm Colette Short, and I'm a regulatory consultant and nutritionist. I think the most exciting area currently, from my perspective, is the whole gut-brain axis, both from a research perspective and also a food innovation perspective, because it offers so many targets there beyond the gut. So it targets the gut, but also areas like mood, anxiety, depression, areas that Louise has mentioned. And I think in the UK in particular, we are in a really good place to develop that science base. So that's where I think, if I was putting my money, that's where I would be putting my chips at the moment.
Thank you very much. Let's start with a basic question, Amy. If someone's gut isn't happy, what are the signs?
Sure. It actually really supports Colette's point, I think. There are signs that we are probably all quite aware of. You naturally go to your digestion with thinking and relating gut health to digestion, sluggish digestive system, maybe some bloating. But actually what we're really finding out more, again, to support Colette's point is, you know, your mind is so linked to the gut, your immune system, it's all in the gut. So this gut-brain connection, we're finding through supporting gut health, your skin can be better. So for the opposite of that, if you are sleeping badly, if you do have sluggish digestive system, if you are finding that you're stressed, then often it can now be linked back to the gut, and we're just finding more and more science to prove that.
Thank you. Talking about science and the body of science, Colette, what, can you speak about the quality of the research body that's going on around this?
Yeah. I guess, you know, today we've been talking about quite a wide range of ingredients, and I would say that the science, I think, in many respects is still emerging. But what I've seen, I would say, in the last 5 years in particular, is that the types of trials that are being done are more robust and more elegantly designed, so that we're starting to see, I would say, real evidence and real pointers to effects. And there have been some really good reviews recently showing not just animal data or in vitro data, but actually human data. So one would be Low in Nature, where I think they outline all of the human studies that have been done, and these are like double-blind placebo-controlled studies. And I think that that's one area that's really important, that I don't think any one company on their own are going to be able to pull together the evidence. But back to Louise's point, and I liked what Louise illustrated, is we need more collaboration between different diverse stakeholders to get large size studies and to get those tangible benefits and real outcomes presented in the science.
Okay. And picking up on this and building on this, so Swami, what do you think are the biggest hurdles to go from the science into a product actually that you can sell?
For the last several years, I've been trying to develop gut health products. And the biggest challenge I have seen, especially in the FMCG products, is to have a product that people perceive it to be good for your gut health. So which means if you're talking about oats, the porridge, and when you have oats high in fiber, and if you make claims on oat good for your gut health, people can understand that. As opposed to you have a drink which is good for your gut health because it has fiber, people do not associate that one. And again, when you're talking about having, developing a product which tastes nice, which is good for your gut, then based on fiber, it could be a challenging one because not every product you can develop, because you cannot load that much of fiber into that particular product. So which means that the kind of product that you develop, you will be limited with the options of what you can develop and where you can make the gut health claim. And for example, like anything which is based milk-based, because it has calcium, it's good for your digestive enzymes, then people understand that, and it's much easier to communicate that message through gut health kefir or gut health yogurt.
So we mentioned claims here.
Yeah.
How can we unlock this? How can we make sure we can actually use claims? And because obviously at the moment there are some regulatory barriers, I guess, in terms of using, being able to use claims. How can we unlock this? Is it by delivering better science, or what? How can we convince this?
I think companies need to really plan the design of their trials very carefully. I think in the past there have been a lot of trials that were perhaps started too hastily without considering the claims aspect at the end. So I think you need to consider, what parameters are you going to measure? What population are you going to use? Are you going to use a stratified population, which might give you more chance but might limit your applicability of the claim? So I think this whole area of designing the trial and spending a lot more time on that is very, very important. And I think that's one of the areas where industry may have fallen down in the past. And of course, the larger the trial, the better as well. But it costs. So this is a very expensive venture. And, you know, I've been in situations where you're trying to get that money internally, whereas you're up against, oh, will we just change the type of package or change the color or change the font size, which are a lot less risky. So I think gather around key people, good researchers who have the methodologies, who understand the populations, who can maybe recruit quickly. bring in regulatory people early on.
This is where I was going.
Go to Camden, ask very early on. But unfortunately, I think within industry, there's often a feeling that we don't want to bring these people to the table early because they'll say no and they'll tell you the barriers. Mm. And what happens is rushing in, pushing through, marketing will often push through things, and you end up with trials that you can't use at the end.
Because I know there's a whole long list of people chomping at a bit, but the barrier is regulatory and they can't get
used. And it's huge. Claims. It's huge. I mean, I having been in industry for quite a long time, that barrier in trying to convince everybody around the table that it's worth to invest maybe £200,000 to £300,000 and showing the return on that investment is very difficult. Mm. And you need a lot of support from external researchers. You need people who are very innovative, that, you know, you need your salespeople to buy into it. It's quite a dynamic and difficult task internally within companies.
Do you want to build on that, Yelena?
So I agree with some of the points, but I'm going to throw in something different. From my perspective, and I have dealt with EFSA, for example, especially for prebiotics over a period of 9 years, and FDA in the US for other products. I think the problem we have, this is my conclusion from what I have seen, is not lack of evidence. We have plenty of evidence. However, evidence is suggestive that we can't produce the benefits with the current definition of gut health. So I think we have a problem with the concept. And for as long as we're trying to present the products to the regulators that are based on change or feed your microbiota, balance the microbiota, and microbiota is important in X, Y, Z. So if you eat this or drink that, and you're going to improve your metabolism, etc., we're going to have a problem. Because there is absolutely no chance that we can establish that cause and benefit or cause and an effect relationship, which is required for any claim and for any regulatory body. So I think the problem is the concept. We need to move away from there. We need to choose different parameters. We need to concentrate on the biomarkers that actually measure bodily functions that mean something to people. We have to move away from this idea, even to a consumer, of balance your gut, or gut health is good for you, for your brain, or this and that. What does that mean? We have now thrown in so many biotics on the market. Consumers don't need to know the definitions. They need to know the benefit. And that benefit can no longer be related to the microbiota or the umbrella of gut health, which doesn't mean very much. It really needs to be focused. So I think the main issue is the concept.
If I can just add, I'm not sure if I totally agree with you.
That's okay.
You know, if you look at Canada, they have actually quite a lot of prebiotic claims that have been authorized. And I think consumers, once they take products, they will know if it works for them as well. They might not be interested whether it's postbiotic or an abiotic or whatever. But I agree with you that I think we need to focus on what are the parameters that we can measure. And why I think gut-brain axis is great is that it opens up a whole complex areas of parameters that can be measured, like sleep, like mood, like anxiety, which are all linked to gut health and which consumers, I think, can understand.
Mm. The consumer education piece is there,
But there are two different things, what consumers can understand and what the regulators
The microphone.
So in terms of the regulators, we won't be able to... Gut-brain axis is one of the best examples because there are a lot of mechanistic studies. We have gathered a lot of evidence. We are finally moving from correlation to causation. But we now need to translate that into humans. And that's lacking, and that's going to take some time. And consumers don't need to know that. And you are right. If it works for them, great, they're going to buy it again. But the question was around the health claims and the regulation. There is absolutely no chance that you're going to get the claim by saying, oh, well, I have increased the whatever the bacteria you want or reduced whatever you want, and therefore I have seen the effect on sleep. That we have tried that over the last 20 years. There's been a lot of evidence presented to EFSA or the FDA, and it hasn't gone through because it's really difficult to show that cause and benefit when you do the indirect interaction. So I think they're two separate things.
Okay, we've established that there's we're going to move on from there. Did you want to add something to it?
Yeah, in the lack of the proper mechanism to establish the proper health claims, and we still people still need to consume healthy food, which is good for your gut health. So the way I see as a product developer is to use the consumer's perceived health benefit of the products like probiotics. Postbiotics, even the prebiotic, use their perceived benefit, but also use an authorized nutrients that will enable you to make claims on your product. So that's probably the best combination as of now to bring a product which is commercially viable in the market.
Thank you, Swami. So I'm just going to open the question to the floor for a minute. Questions? Yes, Louise. Bear with us. Yeah, little trot. We have a gallop.
It can be loud. Yeah. Okay.
No, we liked the gallop.
I just wanted to come back to what Colette said about claims and building evidence base for claims. And I think one of the really most important things is that I've looked at lots of dossiers and given lots of advice on them. And sometimes the advice has been, no, don't even expose yourself, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Because what I would say is that one study, even if well-planned, even if large, will not make a claim. And one of the issues for anyone trying to make a claim in this area is that you have to look at the entirety of the evidence. And I think one of the problems there is that if the field is flooded with badly designed, mm-hmm. poor studies that are not properly powered and properly resourced, then the entirety of the evidence will never look to an outsider as if it is beneficial for a claim, mm. even if you have one study that's very convincing. I think the other thing is we should never use the word prove in this field. Mm-hmm. It's about the weight of the evidence. It is not about solid proof.
Okay.
And then I think on a positive note, one of the things that I would encourage people to do is to look at some of the co-funding opportunities that are there that do de-risk some of that research a little bit for the companies. So that's things like the Open Innovation Research Clusters that Gary and I are both involved in. It's things like the National Alternative Protein Innovation Centre that has competitive funding rounds. It's also working with things like the Co-Centre for Sustainable Food Systems. And so there are these established expert groups where you can, and also Innovate UK, where you can actually get some support that would de-risk it. But like Colette said, it's really about the quality of the evidence and having the right people involved in generating that evidence.
Okay.
From the outset is really, really important.
Thank you, Louise. Very helpful. Any, yes, Maria.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very interesting. I just have a quick question related to the barriers of having those claims on pack. And ultimately, when I look into the market, into the shelves, we do see some claims there, like the gut health claims and prebiotics and all of these. And I've always questioned it, like how some people are able to get it into their products versus others when we know they're not approved by the European Commission. So I don't know if anyone has the answer, but like how some of these sort of companies are able to get these products on the market with these claims that are actually not approved. That's one question. And the other question is relates to postbiotics, because obviously there's a more novel concept. And so far, I've not seen it so much coming into the actual products on shelves. And I wonder if there is any barriers or is it something that is going to come in future. Thank you.
I can take that. So to your first question, I think it's an issue of, number one, particularly for probiotics, the European situation is a complete disharmonious situation where sometimes the word is allowed for food supplements in some countries, but not for foods, and in others it's not allowed for either. But in even those countries, you can find the terms being used. And it comes down to enforcement. In some countries, there's very lax enforcement. In others, there might be. And I think enforcement might differ as well in relation to the size of the product. If you're a very large brand and very you might not want to take the reputational risk of a claim, whereas if you're a very small brand, you might say it's worth the chance. So I think that, and the second question was about, so postbiotics, and I think you answered it actually in your question, because you mentioned that postbiotics are novel, and I think many postbiotics would actually possibly have to go through novel foods approval, which is extremely costly, I would say even more costly than a health claim approval process. So possibly that's why, and also it's an emerging area.
For the claims, very often they are not actually claims. They are very clever use of marketing around what's allowed. And bigger guys are very, very good at that. But also I agree with what Colette said, that smaller companies will take the risk because you will be notified and asked to remove products before you are sued. For postbiotics, I disagree that all postbiotics will have to go through the novel food applications, because in very many cases, if they are from probiotics, they are already on something called QPS list in the EU, or they are already grassed, generally recognized as safe in the US. So it's just a question of presenting the evidence around the safety. But that's just to be able to sell them and say that they're safe for consumption. If you want the health claims, then you're going to have to go through the same process as any other. The benefit, I think, of those products is that you'll be able to demonstrate the claim. And I have to disagree. I found EFSA one of the most difficult organizations in the world to deal with the exception of Anvisa in Brazil, which is actually the most difficult. But I do agree with EFSA. I didn't for a long time, but now I agree with EFSA. As long as we can't show that mechanism, it's going to be difficult. And I see, and that's why, or one of the main reasons why I see postbiotics as heading that way. But we don't have the current products on the market, with the exception of that bacterial isate, which has been on the market for a long, long time, but it has never been marketed as a postbiotic. It's marketed as something immuno. Something, yes, I can't
some
remember.
Way around it, yeah. Thank you, Yelena.
So
we're going to change topic. Thank you. Great. Any other questions? Oh, yep. Oh, hang on.
I'm going to probably bring this back to earth. from my perspective, I'm a guy who plays with food and beverages. So how do we make this delicious? How do we make this a food or a drink, a beverage, and give this an opportunity to succeed and grow? Because it is a subject that is growing. Yeah. And a lot of people are leaning in on this. So how do I, as someone who plays in the kitchen, bring this alive? I come to R&D sessions from a perspective of bringing gold standard ideas. So they start small, but then looked at how can we scale them up? How can we do that?
So
I can answer that if nobody else.
And the practical.
So that's with probiotics, that's going to be difficult because of how they have to be shelved and processed and everything else. With prebiotics, you can do that in some cases. With postbiotics, you'll be able to do that whichever way you want, because you'll be able to add them in anything. I'm currently working with a company in the US who's making a chocolate, but a healthy chocolate, so without the sugar, without anything else, with the added polyphenols and things like that, and also added postbiotics. So I think the benefit of those in the future will be that you'll be able literally to put them in anything you like.
but also I think in terms of having developing recipes or meals, or you know, that would be good for your gut health. So what can you do practically to have a menu or menu items that would benefit your gut health?
Education, I suppose.
Yeah.
Something good, and we feel good.
As it stands, like of the fibers available in the market, probably inulin is the one which is very compatible with lots of different products and product formats, you know, which it doesn't really take away the taste profile of the product and the, you know, the sweetness of the product and the textural profile of the product. That's the one, one ingredient which I find it to be more practical for everyday product. One can use for the gut health and the enrichment of fiber, but for that the other ones, you know, they're a bit hard to work with. Oat fiber, barley fiber, wheat fiber, they are hard.
But Amy, if somebody wanted to improve their gut health today, what would they need to do?
Sorry.
If somebody wanted to improve their gut health today.
Yeah, if somebody wants to improve their gut health today, I think diet is and food is definitely number one. And I think that we're kind of going a little bit full circle with our understanding on gut health and how we are looking after our guts, you know, going back to fiber being, you know, one of the most important parts of your diet that has been pushed to the side, and it may be not related to the gut, but, you know, eating the rainbow, as we've heard many a times. And it's important to have that foundation of, you know, going back to the 30 grams of fiber, and then you can add other, you know, parts to your diet, the protein, of course. But yeah, for me, it's just going back to basics a little bit. And, you know, that's just from a digestive perspective, sleep, stress, managing your stress levels. It all works hand in hand with the gut. Yeah.
I think you should take Louise's recipe brochure as a starter.
Oh yes, that's right. With the lentils
and the lentils
and the beans.
Yes,
you got it.
Yeah, and I think from a drinks point of view, I'd look at the Japanese market and see the innovative ways that they can that they have to incorporate some ingredients that might prove difficult from a sensory perspective. You know, they have a lot of sensorial ways of improving drinks. So I would look at products on that market, in particular for novel ideas.
Thank you. We had a question. Yep, lady with the glasses, Holly. Yeah. Thank you.
So you did mention that we should be, the safest way to go about the product development is going to be using the perceived health benefits. But also when we started the conversation, we also mentioned and discussed that there are only so many of those products that the consumers usually would relate to the gut health, like oats, but a drink would be something very difficult to market to the consumers. Yeah. So if we are going by the perceived health benefits, there would be only so much ingredients or the products that we can play around with. So how would you take that a bit further in case of product management, product development?
Yeah, especially if you want to launch a commercially successful product with an authorized claim, we are actually limited to what kind of products we can, you know, in what kind of products we can make this health claim on. So, which is essentially based on fiber as we stand. So, not every product format is compatible for this one, especially the drinks I see, because when it comes to fibers, there are conditions, and I see in the market, even the brands have missed the conditions. They just have a certain amount of fiber, and then they say, without considering the conditions, they make the gut health claim. So to have a legitimate claim, it's mostly in the food, not so much with the drinks, and only certain foods you can make this, and you can include these fibers, likes of inulin, likes of other, you know, the fibers. That's the reality. There are not many products. So what I'm saying is, one, you need to have those in nutrients like fiber, which will fiber and calcium. Actually, calcium is more compatible with different product formats. So they will give you authorized claims, but at the same time, you have to use the perceived benefit ingredients, like of probiotics, like lactobacillus, if you're postbiotics. Which people know these days that, you know, probiotics are good for you, but you can't make the health claim. But you can make the health claim based on the other nutrients, but use these other perceived benefit ones so that people understand. I mean, you know, this is not bypassing anything, but that's the reality. That's how we can communicate the message.
Thank you. We're actually running out of time here, and I wanted to ask one question because it's one of my pet topic and a privilege here. I was at a meeting with people from NASA. So they're going to put people on Mars by 2040. And they had a long list of things, barriers to achieving this. And one of them in the top three was food and gut health for the astronauts, because they're going to be up there for over 2 years, nearly 3 years. How are you going to feed them to make sure the gut health works? And we know the gut health also affects the mental attitude. They don't get into a fight and all sorts in the space station. So. I suspect there will be a lot of data coming out of this work to understand microbiome and gut health at individual level as well, because we've highlighted the fact that it depends on the individual. But I find that fascinating. I don't know if you had any quick comments on this. You have? Quick.
I would ask them to take a couple of pills of spirulina.
Spirulina.
Yeah, a couple of pills, not as a food, definitely not as a food, but spirulina as pills.
Every day spirulina for 2.5 years.
They need to eat other foods, but to have that, you know, the fiber content and the good protein content and antioxidant, and which they can grow if they want and in the space, spirulina. So that's probably taking spirulina as a grow there, take it as a capsule, the tablets.
And they can grow spirulina in space as well, I guess.
Yeah. That's the one which is experimented. Even NASA has done experiment on that. Yeah.
Any other?
Think there's a Professor Standridge from Boston. It's Holobiome. They're actually working, and I think he's isolating particular strains that might be relevant for the NASA scientists.
No, it's brilliant. Yeah. Anyway, we've run out of time here. Thank you so much. One second. I just got one takeaway for the audience today. So each of you, very quick one takeaway, if you can. And that includes you, Marie, as you're not escaping from this. Whose first takeaway, short?
Gut health isn't about microbes. It's about supporting the body that deals with them.
Bring expertise to the table very early on when you want to develop claims.
Thank you. So me?
Try to develop gut health products which makes sense to the consumers.
Yes, very good. Amy?
Gut health isn't just a fad, it's just the beginning. There's a lot more to be researched and found out for gut health.
Quite, yes. Mariette, you got a... Okay, so educate the consumers. That's Maria's point. Right, well done. A big round of applause. And to yourselves as well. And this is the end of a beautiful day. Thank you so much. Safe travels.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we have some exciting news to share. In 2026, we're hosting two major events. We'll be in London in June, and we're back in Rotterdam in September. Visit foodmatterslive.com to register and join us as we inspire the future of food.